Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the call-in talk show about health and natural medicine. It's May 22nd, 2019. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. I'm here with my co-host, Ron Meniza.
Hey.
If you'd like to participate in the conversation about natural medicine, you can call 860-486-9487. That's 860-486-9487. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also check out my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at FranStorchND. Today, it's my pleasure to once again introduce my very special guest, Carl Goldkamp, ND, naturopathic physician in Bern, North Carolina. Carl is a naturopathic doctor, acupuncturist, certified in Chinese herbal medicine and environmental medicine. He was the first graduation speaker at Bastyr University to graduate with 2 degrees, doctor of naturopathy and also an MS in acupuncture. He's got over 16 years of clinical experience as a naturopathic doctor working with diet and lifestyle change. He's worked with many, many different conditions. And he's also treated people with environmental exposures, designed detox programs, and tested for genetic variants to more specifically support detox pathways with targeted nutrition. You can find Carl Goldkamp's website at http://ketonaturopath.com. So there you have it. Welcome to Radio Naturopath, Carl.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good, good. One correction on the address. It's Keto Naturopath, not Ketone Naturopath. But anyway.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Right. Keto Naturopath. It's not the word ketone, then naturopath. It's just K-E-T-O, then the word naturopath. And it's all lowercase, one word.
You got it.
Sweet.
Anyway, good to talk to you again. Right?
You too. How's the weather in North Carolina?
Well, you know, we moved down from Cape Cod, and we lived there about 5 years in southern Connecticut. And the spring lasts a few hours here. Right now, you know, we are in the 90s this week, and next week I think we'll get into the hundreds. And I go in May.
Oh my God!
Wow.
Huh.
Yeah.
The spring lasts a few hours.
More or less. That's
wow.
But really presents the question: how long does it take to fry an egg on the hood of your car come August?
Oh
my goodness!
There you go.
Mm. Wow.
Well, you'll have to experiment with that and get back to us.
I know, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Had a lot of suggestions of how to cook it, too, right?
Oh, my goodness. So, you know, since I spoke to you in February, it really sparked my interest in, in the keto diet, and particularly in your version of it, which is the carnivore keto diet. I have a number of patients who were already doing the keto diet before I spoke with you. And then since I saw you, there were a couple of patients who came in who I thought that keto carnivore would be appropriate for them. So I started them on it. As yet, nobody has stuck to it 100%. But perhaps you have some advice about that. So, Carl, please start wherever you'd like. The first question I have is, what do you actually eat? Or, you know, if there's something more important, please start there.
No, it all comes down to, in the end, people have objectives. Like, usually it's losing weight and so on. That wasn't the case with me. But if it can be sustained and if they enjoy it, then it will work.
Right.
You know, an act of discipline for a short period of time, it's not going to work. You know, that's
right.
Where it goes. So, see what I found, you know, I worked with patients up at Duke with Dr. Westman. I got to sort of see his program, which was pretty much the legacy of Dr. Atkins. And it was all good. But when, you know, and I really love the teaching of the man because he's very candid and open, is that, you know, he said at best we get 50% success rate, which means of all the patients they see, and it's mostly insurance patients, it's not the affluent people who can pay out of pocket, though a few do come through that door as well, that 50% of the people, and my guessing is closer to 60%, just it doesn't take with them. So the reason is why. And so I think people need to be coddled a little bit and to, yeah, you sort of start with a food list, but it ends up being pretty intuitive. And we've worked with people that are a Hindu vegan, how's that? Not only that, are they phobic of animal meat and they're strictly vegetarian. And that's a hard place to begin. So we had to work with saying, can we try a little eggs? You know, that didn't work. So we had to go to powdered eggs. And we did some nutrient spectra cell tests and said, you know, I just feel badly for you because, you know, you're flying above the trees and I don't know when we're going to crash. And I don't perceive we're gaining any altitude here. So we micromanaged her to, you know, gradually building out other food she can eat. So the reason I say that, it varies from very difficult people to come in, and she was actually a very successful person in the end. But for what I eat, I don't really eat, and it's not an act of discipline until after 12. I would say I'm primarily a carnivore, but I think I disqualify that. I disqualify myself in that because Judy tends to make, you know, keto, call them crepes or pancakes, which are carb-free, and so obviously that's not, you know, chomping on something meat. So except for those exceptions, I'm pretty much all meat. But so what does that mean? I have I've learned to like liver, and I obviously like eggs, and I like that because of the choline source, among other things. It's one of the few fatty organs of the body that is easily accessible in the supermarket. So we blend it up, you know, we cook it, and we blend it up, and I make liverwurst. So I have a stash of liverwurst for my fallback. What else do we have? You find your snack foods are, you know, make a mischief. We make our own mayo. We have a stash of, you know, already cooked bacon that we've cooked. And so there's that. Then it comes down to really, what are you going to do for the one meal a day, which is dinner, 5:30, 6 o'clock. Primarily, it is meat. We do have our supply of salmon, so we have that. I have some chicken. I have some pork. And I just find this lifestyle is so easy. And so the question is it satisfying? And it becomes satisfying when you just let the discipline go. The discipline meaning, how much should I eat? You know, how many proteins, grams of proteins? I mean, I measure that once every other month now just to make sure I'm on track.
Yeah.
But other than that, you know, I got to eat to being full. And
exactly.
And so that's it. So it works for me. For others, they come from such a processed food perspective that for them the big step is getting away from processed food, which is totally kind of what we all did naturopathically. It's like get the junk out and have it be real food. If you're onto whole foods, what we call it, you know, and then it's an easier place to start. Then we're simply making better choices. But if you're a processed food person and you've rationalized it in your life because you're so busy, say you stop by McDonald's, actually you can do this at McDonald's. There's some good choices there. But or you've got this little bag of things and that little bag of things, you have to sort of drop that. And so that's hard. If you have a lifestyle that's been bagged food forever, having to go to whole food is a big step.
But right. Whether you're keto or carnivore or not, just going to whole food is a huge step for a lot of people.
Yep. And that's clearly been the big difference. So we've done a number of coaching groups, you know, started for free and then gradually have elaborated our course and made it more expensive, I should say. And so what we found is the biggest differentiation was those who are processed food addicts, pretty much, and those who weren't, you know, and that's a big step. So once you're into a whole food-ish orientation, then it's simply saying, all right, what do we drop, which is really the grains and the starches. But the controversy that are in front of us now, especially as a naturopath, is that you could drop, you know, there is no such thing as essential carbohydrate. Absolutely no such thing. You know, and the challenge of what about fiber? You know, that's being challenged too. Is fiber really necessary? And so we go, well, wait a minute. You need fiber to make these short chain fatty acids. Butyrate. Oh, really? Butyrate? Well, butyrate is what you get from the ketogenic diet.
Right.
You know, so, and so, you know, this is dogma for hundreds of years, and certainly deep into our naturopathic philosophy. You know, your phytonutrients and so on and so forth, weren't they essential?
Well, not if you go to the Arctic.
Right. That's a great example. You know,
and or the Mongolians.
Mm-hmm. Both of them. And so the that brings up the research a guy named Stefan Johansson did back in the turn of the century. He was an Arctic explorer. He ended up at Dartmouth, and he started a it's called Cold Regions Research. But what he did, he spent about 6 years with the Inuits back then, back when it was an unpolluted part of the world. And he ate like they ate. And when he came back to the United States, he's actually Canadian, of Icelandic origin. When he came back to the United States, he and one of his co-explorers said, you know, vegetables and carbs are not necessary. And guess what? You can study me. So he went into, I think it was Mount Sinai, and let himself be studied, he and his colleague. And so they stayed in the hospital for a couple months, and then to really measure everything they ate, you know, totally study it, do blood work and so on and so forth. This is now the early 30s. And so after a couple months, they said, well, you know, you can go home, but just write down everything you eat. Or assume you're going to be honest. And so they tracked him for a year, and they found there was no ill health. And so that was the beginning of it. So this is sort of just rediscovering what has been discovered before, but it was, not a popular message to bring across to the public.
Right. Yeah. And one of the, of course, there's all these criticisms that absolutely, like, if you don't have the fiber, what's that going to do to your microbiota?
Right. Yes. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. That's where I started, right? So my story, to clip it to the last interview, was, you know, I had severe Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. So
I know. That's what I explain to people, because I tell your story all the time. I hope you don't mind. But
no,
I figure because it's on, you have it on the internet, so I figure it's okay. But I tell your story, and I have people say, well, I might be able to do that for a little while, but then I would try other things, or that's not something I can do. And I said, well, Carl does it because it saved his life. He has to do it because the alternative is basically death.
Yeah, you know, and you know that is the grandest and perfect place to begin. It's what is the person's motivation? You know, back to the whole Viktor Frankl thing of being a survivor of World War II, the Holocaust, and everything. And that, you know, he came out. He's like, you need to have a reason. People either change because they have to or because they want to, but usually it's because they have to.
Right, and, right. And so you had no choice.
That's right. And so with that, how I interpreted that motivation, I mean, and people can say, it's fine, you had the motivation, but how'd you come up with an answer? Well, I didn't come up with the answer right away. I went deep into the whole microbiota thing. I, you know, went down and to the international conferences specifically on FMT, fecal microbiota transfer. I think it's just called FT now.
Yes.
And learned all about that. I did do that with my wife for 3 months. And so that, you know, I talked to the world experts in Australia and Belgium and, you know, and it's totally fascinating. And so it brings this idea, what is the perfect microbiota? Well, there isn't any. You know, it's collections of families. You know, if you eat veggies, you're going to have a certain orientation to your microbiota. Mm. You eat meat, if you eat, and so on and so forth. But what I learned is, you know, we're looking at the wrong end, so to say, because if I change my diet, I change my microbiota. And I know there's industries of supplements, so it's in part as a naturopathic thing as well and as commercial, is that they go, no, the whole probiotic aspect, and there's a place for probiotics, but I've questioned that as well. I think it's very useful post-antibiotics and making sure you don't create harm because of using antibiotics. But however, trying to guide your microbiota by taking supplements outside of an acute situation is bogus in my idea.
Wow.
Your microbiota is created by your diet. And so really, we got to move up the alimentary canal from the rectum up to the mouth and even further up to the head and saying, what are we eating? And, you know, this is the source of our microbiota. Well, before we get into, I'm hypochlorhydric because my stomach acid. Well, you know, let's get back to the food. Mm-hmm. And not everybody starts at the same place. Not everybody starts with equal efficiency, but eventually they straighten out. You know, and so you go, well, what's the cause of ill health? At least that's where my mind goes. And it is, I would say, the processed foods, and that we can have as much of the garbage we like to eat, you know, forever. You know, the worst food is the cheapest food to have. And we've been pointing that out for a long time. So that's not a new message, but the message is it drives blood sugar problems. And the blood sugar from there is, you know, obviously diabetes, prediabetes, dysglycemia. That moves on to heart disease. And so that door is a massive growth for a lot of ill health. But that's the door you know, that is the door. It's not one of many, in my view. And so that's a big deal. You know, it is so fascinating because it goes deeper and deeper. And finally, the serious research is starting to happen just in this last couple of years. So I like going to these conferences and tie into the various people that I interview as well. And so what was my thought here? Some of the current issues are really coming back to not just the components of food, the macros, you know, your carbs or lack of carbs or your fat and your protein, and how much, that's all valid. That's a good conversation to have, and it's a good piece of understanding to have. And then you go into the kind of fats, and you go into, you know, what are the better proteins. But that's, we're still, you know, it's still at the same level. It's really the emotional addiction to carbohydrates and what carbohydrates bring in. And this is like, really? Now we're just talking about carbohydrates? We're no longer talking about just grains and starches? The conversation is much bigger than that.
Sure.
And I think this is my reflection of my education, being a naturopath now and looking elsewhere around the world, is that I feel it's on the verge of saying, you know, I think there was an agenda through our naturopathic education of being very plant-based. You know, I don't remember in my education going in, now we're going to talk about meat, and, you know, we talked about protein generically, whether it was a pea protein or whether it was a cow protein.
Yeah, I mentioned this at the last, when we spoke in February, which was when I was in school. So remind me again what year you graduated?
98.
And I graduated in 95, and you were up at Bastyr, and I was down at National. Anyway, yep. So I graduated in 95. So 91 and 95, you know, of course, we were all talking about, you know, you've got to get away from the processed foods and you want to eat whole foods. And there's a lot of issues with, you know, with dairy and with meat in that, you know, there, you've got a lot. You've got pesticides. You've got the whole pesticide because they're high up on the food chain. You've got their lifetime of pesticide consumption and toxins and hormones and antibiotics. And so the solution to that at that time was everybody should be a vegan, that being a vegan was the healthiest thing that you could do.
Right.
And we've come full circle on that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely have. And, you know, I guess that so back to that grain of sand point of motivation about, you know, for me, it was about saving my life. And I then had to say, well, you're not a dummy and you don't need to be Einstein to figure this out. So go do it. You know, sort of don't be perfect. So
I'm so glad you did, because what you did is going to help so many people.
Here's hoping. I think so. You know, and it's interesting. So if you can find it, we can simplify this in saying you have to find somebody's why. But usually if they're coming to our office, then it's because they have pain. And so you have to sort of line up their pain with the motivation. But
well, the first patient that I put on, that I said, why don't you try being a carnivore? The way it happened was I was talking to her about what she was eating. She had pain all over. She's an older lady, and she had pain all over her body. And when I talked to her, she told me, I'm not a big vegetable eater. Oh. I said, you're not, are you? I said, why don't you try this? And I talked to her about this lifestyle, and she was game. And my next visit with her, I don't know that she's sticking to it 100%, but but the next visit, she had lost a bunch of weight, and her pain was much reduced. And so her motivation is a lot of, you know, debilitating musculoskeletal pain. So the thing is with you, I mean, people can live with a certain amount of pain, and people can live with a certain amount of body fat. You can't live if you have severe Crohn's colitis. Did you have Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, or did you have both?
I had both.
Yeah, okay. So you had Crohn's colitis. Yes, and to clarify, Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis are inflammatory, are in the category of inflammatory bowel disease. And ulcerative colitis, when you're talking about ulcerative colitis, you're talking about ulcerations in the colon. So you're pretty much specifically talking about the colon. And then you can have inflammation. Crohn's disease is an inflammatory bowel disease that occurs anywhere from mouth to anus and anywhere in between. And so there's inflammation as well. There's characteristic histology, meaning there's characteristic cellular things that you see. And one of the really dangerous things with Crohn's disease is the inflammation can become so severe you can get blockages. So it is possible to get them together. And some people, they're not sure which diagnosis. And in the end, it doesn't matter. Naturopathically, we treat them both and we think of them both similarly. I wouldn't say exactly the same. And you know, you're going to, so in your case, of course, you're treating them the same way. So inflammatory bowel disease subsets, Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, are not irritable bowel disease. They're not the same, or irritable bowel syndrome. They're not, they're very different. One is a functional condition where you have no histological changes, no changes in the cellular structure. And one is a very serious inflammatory disease that can predispose you to to gastrointestinal cancers.
Yeah, I see it basically as a spectrum, even though we don't have all the dots in a row.
That it's a spectrum, that people have varying levels of inflammation in their bodies and in their digestive systems.
The thing we have in common naturopathically when somebody comes through the door, generally, classically, I should say, is we're trying to reduce inflammation in that part of the body.
Yes.
That's what everybody's trying to do. And so allopathically, meaning MDs, for the most part, they give very strong medications. I've been on them. You know, you have to, and they're trying to shut down your entire immune system. For instance, anti-tumor necrosis factor alpha. So
right.
They say, well, if we can just block that, block, you know, and so it is, and I'm trying not to be critical. I understand, it had to save my life. So my wife thinks for the couple of months I was on those meds that it helped me. I don't know, because they had a lot of other side effects. But that's the thinking.
So you actually took some monoclonal antibodies.
Oh, absolutely. No, okay. When nobody else can help you, and I had reached out to a number of other NDs, and it was just too light. You know, it was just not heavy enough, and because most NDs don't go there. You know, it's just like, yeah, you're beyond my help, buddy.
Right.
You know, I'm sorry. You know, we're well beyond any probiotics or whatever supplements. And so you're left with, shut this down no matter what. I don't really care. I'm not judging. Please shut it down. And so they do that. First, they think they can shut it down with steroids. And if that doesn't work, they go, oops, the biggest cannon just got removed from the scenario. Now, where else can we go? So you basically do monoclonal antibodies. And there was a couple of meds. I don't remember all of them, but
The big one is adalimumab or Humira.
Yeah, there should be a class action suit against that.
But, and also, and Remicade is another big one that I see people get put on.
Yeah, and so when you realize that it may be something, you know, it's not like you're
going to... So wait, back up. So what's your issue with adalimumab?
Arthritic. In other words, when I came back in, and it's really interesting, I reported this to the second doc that I went to and said, you know, maybe it's helping me internally. We can't look at that on a regular basis. They would look at your mouth to see you're not getting ulcerations, as you mentioned. And they said, well, okay, I guess we're not causing a problem. But it was incredible arthritic pain, especially low back and knees. And so I would almost crawl into the office by saying, well, maybe that's better. But this certainly, you know, got worse.
So the adalimumab gave you severe arthritic pain, musculoskeletal pain.
Yep.
And wow.
It's funny. You know what's funny about that? You know where the acronym Humira comes from? It stands for Human Monoclonal Antibody for RA. So
right.
It's basically, and so you go,
that makes no sense.
Right. It makes no sense.
Right, and they give the monoclonal antibodies for a variety of inflammatory conditions. You'll see it given for, if you see the ads on TV, they give it for inflammatory bowel disease. Acne, I haven't seen that advertised. I didn't know they did that. But they definitely give it for psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis.
Yeah.
And they give it for, I've seen it. I'm pretty sure they use it for asthma sometimes.
They're finding more and more. There was a period of time I spent a lot of time in doctor's offices, of course, so you go through all those magazines, and Humira is in every magazine you can pick up in a doctor's office.
Yes,
so,
for numerous conditions, and certainly they give the monoclonal antibodies for rheumatoid arthritis.
Right, right. And
yeah.
so you get so caught up in the medication and the side effects of the medication, and it goes on and on and on, that here, you know, take me, but there's 100 people like me, take me that says, you know, I haven't been on any medications for, was it 5 or 6 years, you know, and I have no arthritis, and, you know, I am good. And
right.
So people are on carnivore, and one of the things that people go on carnivore for is for arthritis.
Absolutely.
OA or RA.
Yes.
And who would have thought you could put OA and RA in the same category with the same treatment? You know, that's not how I learned it.
And also PA. I see so many people diagnosed with psoriatic arthritis.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it really is psoriatic arthritis, but that's what they get diagnosed with. They get psoriatic arthritis. I see psoriatic arthritis. I see just osteoarthritis. I see rheumatoid arthritis. And then I see people get diagnosed with polymyalgia rheumatica.
Right. Right.
And they're all candidates for this, I think.
They are. They are. So the fun that I'm finally starting to have in terms of treating people, and we just think they have a program, small program, about 10 people. It takes about 4 months, and we have to line up the labs. Now you can go get labs independently. You know,
yes.
You go, hey, you're going to go get these labs. And so, you know, we really start to do it before and after, and it's mostly for the education of the patient. And you know, they just want their symptoms to go away, or their weight to go away, but usually the problem's a lot bigger. You know, if most people are unaware of, you know, their hemoglobin 1AC, it's, you know, they're saying,
yeah.
No, I have pain. Why am I looking at, you know, H1C? Well, it's connected. Believe me, it's connected. You line these things up and you go, I just sort of see the pattern and saying, this is such a wonderful, holistic treatment for so many different things because of the, not just the insulin sensitivity, it's dropping down. And by the way, let's say we all stopped carbs. You know, it's not going to cure the world because we can make glucose. You know, so
yes, you can always do gluconeogenesis. That's right. And
right.
You can also, and you have tens of thousands of, is it tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of calories available in your fat stores?
You have lots. I mean, you have a combination of not just your fat, but of course your glycogen, you know,
yes.
Muscle storage. And,
yes.
And that's an independent variable as well. But the reason I mentioned, you know, the opposite of of insulin is glucagon. And you don't hear anybody saying, oh, his glucagon is up. Nobody takes glucagon. The last time
you took glucagon
was in your physiology class in med school.
That's true. We don't really think about glucagon. Please explain what is glucagon and just give us a refresher on it.
Okay, so glucagon, so insulin, it's a seesaw, right? These are generally, it is believed, they're in opposition. One's up and the other's down. So insulin's function is to kind of a thermostat sense a level of blood sugar, glucose, in the blood, and then saying too much, and it shoots it off to store it in fat. Initially, it's the fat, you know, on your body, and eventually we start running out of other
well,
places.
Well, doesn't it also send it to the liver first to be stored as glycogen?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, there's that. It has a number of addresses in which it shoots this
yes.
stuff away. And so when these addresses start to get filled up, they go, we're running out of addresses. We got a new one? You got a new place we can store? So,
and that would be the last place to go, the repository of the unused glucose, is your fat cells.
Yep. And that's where you can end up having, you know, fatty liver and a fatty
yes.
lot of things. I mean, you get a lot of fat around your heart. It shouldn't
mm-hmm.
be there. Anyway, so that's the insulin side. So the glucagon is the other side, saying our glucose by sensor is, so we're saying, simplifying it, is something that says our glucose is too low. We need to make some glucose. And so it can easily make glucose. So it makes glucose, so hence gluconeogenesis, simply
yes.
making new glucose.
Yes.
And so that's sort of the opposite way. How you get to turning on gluconeogenesis, yes, there is a sensor that says, wait a minute, you know, and other, a cascade of other hormones that turn it on. But the main one is stress and cortisol and epinephrine, norepinephrine, et cetera. It's that voice that goes back millions of years in our evolution that says there's a bear or a wolf or a lion chasing you, make glucose and let's get this body out of here.
Yes.
Climb the tree, run as fast as
you can.
So that's part of what we're about, is our ability to make glucose instantaneously fast and available for the whole freaking body. And so, okay, that's good. Well, now you come into this, and this is why stress is such a hugely interesting. I mean, that was my door into this, obviously, you know. But what it does is that you can be on a high carb diet by being stressed, chronic stress.
Absolutely.
Because you're hitting your we'll call it cortisol, but it's a little more complicated, but cortisol is what will work. Cortisol is now signaling on a regular basis, regardless of what our glucose levels are, measurable glucose levels are in our blood, hitting the glucagon saying, more please, more please, more please. And that's why people can say, I don't eat anything and I'm getting fat. Well, you besides having some
because you're stressed
pathology. Yeah, right.
And I always tell people that you know, that one of the treatments, one I try to emphasize, and for almost anything, certainly for fat loss, but for many, many other things, I try to emphasize to them, stress reduction. It's not just if you reduce your stress, your irritable bowel will get better. Stress reduction is a treatment for your IBS. It's just as important as taking, I don't know, peppermint oil or a probiotic or changing your diet. Reducing your stress treats your IBS. Reducing your stress treats your inflammatory bowel disease. If you are highly stressed, it will be orders of magnitude harder to lose weight. And then if you're stressed and you're also postmenopausal, oy vey, you got a number of things working against you there. But stress, because a lot of people want to lose weight, and you know, a lot of people who come to keto, they come to it because of fat loss, because they've tried everything else and they can't seem to lose weight. But stress is such a huge part of it. I mean, if you are chronically stressed, and if you're chronically stressed in postmenopausal, even worse, it can stymie your fat loss, even if you are on the perfect diet for you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very simple. You have high cortisol. Cortisol's job is, just like you said, cortisol is there so that you can run away from the bear or the lion or the or the macaw or whatever. And its job is to look around and find whatever it can and put sugar into your blood so you have energy to get away from that bear. And so if you've got 100 tiny little bears chasing you all the time in the form of school and work and getting your kids from here to there and taking care of an elderly loved one or taking care of an ill loved one or friend, then you have this constant dumping of cortisol. And while that's going on, it's going to be very hard to heal from most things. And yet, you know, I talk to people about stress, you know, sometimes you have to deal with harm reduction because they're just not going to be able to get away from some of their stressors. So you talk about, you know, doing all the restorative activities, taking breaks, taking rests, and taking some supplements like, you know, your ashwagandha and your rhodiola and your Eleuthero and your ginseng and, you know, name your favorite adaptogen, et cetera.
Right. One of the things that doesn't come up when we talk about stress is, and you can put steroids in here, so medications are the same thing.
Sure.
These medications.
Yes.
Is that we now have the explanation of just what you said, you know, you will gain weight and you're going to be driven, is that the appetite for 100% carbs is huge. And you can go right back as if you were on a high-carb diet, meaning your body has now induced all the blood sugar, all the glucose you wanted. Well, when it takes a break and that drops, suddenly you're going to get just like you had a high-carb lunch and your insulin comes in and shuts it all down. Now you're hypoglycemic.
And you're hungry.
And now you go, oh, my gosh. And so it sets up the pattern, even however unintended, that you're going to go for carbs. You're not going to go for a steak after that. So you now are feeding in those troughs, meaning when the glucose is dropped, and with all the carbs. And so now you've amplified that. So even in a high-stress diet person, And the way I summarize it is when you do stress management, you're really talking about anti-inflammatory management. You
that
know, this
too.
Is why we're doing
of course. Yeah.
So, but as you get into actually producing ketones, you know, measurable ketones, what you're now doing is you're producing increase in GABA, you know, gamma-aminobenzoic acid. And so when you're, so GABA is the meditation hormone, if you will, among
yes.
other things. You know, gabapentin. I mean, there are all so many things are based on top of this.
Yeah, I don't know if GABA. I looked at GABA, the mechanism of action for gabapentin. I don't. I think it's related to GABA, but I don't know if it really does. You know, enhance GABA signal. I'm not sure exactly how it works, but it's not exactly
that. Yeah, well, what's the medication? Right. Now, my point with mentioning that is that pharmaceutically, they're trying to get GABA stimulators as tranquilizers, right?
Yes.
So you have
which sort of makes sense.
Right. It just gets overdone. People want to be blissed out.
Yeah.
But so back to GABA. GABA is the opposite of glutamate, which is, you know, glutamate
right.
stimulator. So
it's excitatory, exactly.
So now whether we're talking about autism or anybody, you know, you're now bringing, not so much you're tranking them out, you're tranquilizing to the point they're non-responsive. No, it's impossible to go in that direction, non-pharmaceutically, that is. And so what you're doing, you're providing a balance, you're bringing it back into balance, and then that balance, even though people are going to feel, if they've been so stressed, they're feeling, gosh, I feel pretty calm now. What the heck is this about? You know, and they get this consciousness, and this is where they get this sort of mental focus as well. So it's like this voice comes into their life and their head by saying, I just feel good breathing right now. I don't have to do all these other things. And so that's kind of the first step is you start stepping away. But that's a side effect.
So when you lower your carbs, you make more GABA.
Too big of a step. When you lower your carbs enough, So I shoot for 20 or less, which is the classic ketogenic.
Wow, that's low.
For some, actually, I don't do any carbs now at all, so it's even lower. So when you get to wherever it is with you, and I tell for our program, we start everybody with we're shooting for 20, and this is how we're going to do it. And after this becomes effective, you can, if you really want to, you can start increasing your carbs and find out where you lose that effect. But let's start in a place we know will create a positive effect. So dropping your carbs to the point that you are now fat adapted, right?
Yes.
Because you're also either burning your fat or you initially increased your fat.
Yes.
And keeping your protein, equal, not higher or lower. That's when you're going to start. The ketones is the producing of the GABA. The lowering the carbohydrate forces the fat metabolism. And so that's it. Just had to put in a few steps there.
So some patients come in and they're like, all right, I'm all for this, and they go keto carnivore. Don't they get the keto flu?
Not always, actually.
Okay.
Keto flu. What's
yes,
that?
Yes. Please explain. Please talk about that, because people always talk about it. Please tell us what is the keto flu. Talk about it and talk about ways to help it.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good topic, and I think it represents really the transition. You know, you have to get people to say, hey, body is making a transition. This isn't like a hack. I hate that expression. This isn't a
right.
Hack. This is metabolically changing your system slowly. You know, so it's not just about producing ketones. It's about these other levels that are, and it goes on for years, actually. So what the keto flu is, the guess on this is that you're having an electrolyte change.
Uh-huh.
And your electrolytes have fallen behind, and so you might even get muscle cramps. You get sort of aches and pains and so on. Some people, it could be addiction to the foods they're leaving as well. So it's a bit of a vague, but I would go with the electrolyte.
I wonder if the keto flu is, it's true, because all of a sudden, when you go off carbs, when you stop eating, you suddenly stop eating a lot of starchy foods and carbs and things. One of the first things that happens is you pee for 3 days, at least. I mean, you lose a lot of body water, and you notice that you go to the bath. I know, even if I just, go on a sugar fast, that happens to me. I'll just get rid of a lot of fluid. So that's one of the things that happens, and that can lead to an electrolyte imbalance. I also wonder if part of the symptoms that people feel are their hormones have to reset. So their insulin has to reset, their cortisol has to reset, their norepinephrine, epinephrine has to reset. And so if you suddenly drop your carbs, of course, it's that thing happens where, you're suddenly, you're not putting in the carbs that you're used to. So you've got that insulin effect or you get that cortisol effect where you're trying to put sugar into your blood and possibly glucagon as well. But if your cortisol suddenly steps in and tries to put more sugar into your blood, when you have high catecholamines, that's part of what gives you the symptoms. And so that takes a while to reset. And some people, this is stepping out on a ledge a bit, but do you think that everybody can do keto carnivore, or are there certain genetic types who do better at it?
Hold that point. I want to go backtrack on the electrolytes for a second.
Okay.
Because when people do make the transition, the two things they do have to be worried about is magnesium initially.
Yes.
And sodium. And so the idea, we call it carnivore, call it the ancestral diet. Back then there was the expression, actually not but 100 years ago, it was a person is worth their salt, meaning salt was rare and salt was one of the things we really coveted. Now we have as much salt as you possibly want.
Right.
And hopefully have a good quality. So salt, sodium specifically, is something that needs to be taken. So that's another opposite of what we our people were used for before. It's like, don't put too much salt in your road, you know, on your food, because you're going to get hypertension and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
It's like, no, now it's necessary. So there's that. Magnesium is the other one. And it's not like, oh, my gosh, I have to supplement magnesium, even though I have some on hand. I have CalMag. But I, for the most part, I just up my sea salt. I put sea salt in my coffee. And I actually don't put it on my food. I don't. It's just that I have never been a salt person. But so I make sure to put it in my coffee and sometimes my tea. So I'm good with that.
Okay, back up just a second. Sea salt in your coffee and your tea. You gotta tell me why.
Oh, well, I actually take the bitterness out. And I'm finding a place to put the salt that I like it. And now it's just become habitual with me.
Others, he doesn't like it on his meat.
Okay.
Like you do.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or
I like it on my meat.
And he doesn't particularly eat salad. As I recall, you said you eat little bits of relishes every few days. Is that right?
And that's, I would say, every few months, because we put Eskie visited us in Mystic. So we made so many, you know, we have a basement full of relishes now, vintage, that we use, you know, periodically on our food, but it's not like a discipline at all.
I see.
It probably takes a couple of months to go through a jar.
So
So it's not very much at all. So no, the only veggies I would have is if I'm out in a social gathering and it's too much attention to avoid my salad. Then I'll have my salad. Whereas we grew and made salads for decades.
Sure.
So salt is important. So wherever you want to put it, it's obviously in our mayo and so on and so forth. Put it on our liverwurst. So there's a meat combination. So I am aware of the salt and the salt. And actually, salt sensitizes your insulin, so it's a good thing. It's a big deal. So other than that, you sort of keep an eye on magnesium. It's not something you have to check. Some people simply say, take bouillon. You know, bouillon's a fairly good source. It never worked for me. Since I'm the naturopath and I can get a supplement, I put that back there. But I only take magnesium if I feel muscle cramp, usually my calves,
sure,
maybe my hamstrings. And other than that, my mind doesn't go to that.
Right.
It's just salt. So that was that part. That's why, that's the keto flu, and that's how I would do it. Some people can go out and buy a supplement that's for all their electrolytes. Is that better?
Yeah.
I don't think necessarily. I think the more you force your body to do, so it's probably a good, healthy crutch, intermittent. And
sure.
It's obviously, it's all the electrolytes.
Helping people to stick with stuff is a big thing in naturopathic medicine.
So when you think of the thing as a transition, think of what are the things that we need to help people with so they don't get, you know, easily deterred and say, I quit? Because in this culture, it's very easy to quit because they don't know who's telling the truth. I totally buy into that. So anyway, so on to the other thing. You're talking about, is there a genetic predisposition? Some people do better than others. What you're really asking is this whole new thing called, not new thing, since 2003, genome, and looking at SNAP, SNPs.
Yes.
Singular nuclear polymorphism. So, interesting story on that. Back in, I think I had just left the Mystic office during my own practice, and I started getting into 23andMe had yet to be out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was in, I think, some conferences I went to, I was introduced to MTHFR, which is a SNP. It's a methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase.
Yes.
And so a SNP is a one amino acid mutation for a common enzyme. You know,
and when we say SNP, it's just an abbreviation for single nucleotide polymorphism.
Correct.
Yes.
And so this is now 2007 to 2010. I was invited up to lecture annually for a couple of days on SNPs that we knew then, and their maybe increased vulnerability they would give to certain medications. And so we looked at, you know, it has to do with B12, folic acid, so what kind of medications also deplete that. And so we got deep into it, and it was a lot of fun, but that was kind of the focus of those things. And so now you say, well, I was definitely excited about the genome and the genome research. So I would say in a normal diet of high carb and high fat, those are relevant issues to have. And when we slide into the ketogenic diet, as you said, things get resensitized. Talked about hormones, cortisol, and so on and so forth, and we find that a lot of people on keto actually had a lower thyroid hormone, but they're not hypothyroid. They
don't
have the symptoms, right? So it's the opposite of clinical hypothyroid. It's clinical.
Yeah, you def. That's one of the things that they tell you to look for, that the person's T3 will go down.
Right. And so then the question is, just because it went down, does it need to be supplemented?
That's a good question, because I've been doing that. I have, because I have supplements that can help. Like I have patients on keto who their T3 drops, so I help them with it.
Right. So this is the re-referencing and getting the data of all these different things that are changing. So speaking to hormones, I had my hormone panel done on me. And it's the guy now 5-6 years on keto to Dutch. So dried urine, comprehensive hormone panel made by Precision. It's out in Oregon and considered to be the best method of tracking all your hormones. And so they do give you everything. And you have nearly a 24-hour period of, you know, peeing on a strip and then drying them out and sending them in, and they give you the graph back. And it's pretty interesting.
Wow.
So what did I find? So per patient report, per my story telling you, I'm fine. Well, when I look at this, I got my androgens are low, and this was thinking, well, this is one poor sucker. Who is he, by the way? You know, and so what I'm saying, and actually, I am one that has this NTHFR SNP and others that cause a lot of issues, and yet they have a methylation part of, are your hormones being methylated appropriately? I was a high methylator.
Uh-huh.
So tying all these things together, but what we don't know is that there was one study that came out that actually showed, looked at microbiome and so on and so forth, that shows a fat-adapted person, a ketogenic person, actually increases their endogenous, self-made folic acid.
Nice.
And so therefore, it affects the folate cycle, the methylation cycle, and beyond what it said, because it's only a study of one so far, and actually it came out of a fatty liver disease study, that is like, well, does that beg the question that a lot of these SNPs are now irrelevant in the world of a ketogenic diet?
That's
I would say, arguably, in the world of the millions of years we lived in a ketogenic diet. And therefore, these genes were primarily only a problem in the high fit, in the standard American diet.
And the standard American stress and lifestyle and toxins, right, and all that stuff.
Right. So it's a big divider. You know, no, we're certainly not in a position now when a patient comes in saying, are you a keto or not? Maybe that day will happen. But it is a subset of, then you go, well, you know, do I treat their thyroid? Because they're fine. Do I treat their hormones? Because they're fine. You know, unless there's a problem, I tend not to treat them.
But, right.
So that's what I saw on me, and that was, you know, more detail than I cared to go into, and certainly for most people it's going to be overkill, because you're going to want to summarize and say, this is what we're going to do. But if there's no problem, I'd say let's move on. So
right.
I went back and consulted with them. It's interesting, and they're a great company. They know nothing about the effects of ketogenic diet on hormones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they're in their box, like we all are. You know, we know X, and X relates to all these other things, but their specialty is looking at this graph and telling you what's high and what's low, and standardly how to treat that. Interesting. And so I go back to, you know, there's companies like Strategy. Now there's a lot of genome analysis companies out there that are more than willing to tell you this is your, you know, perhaps dangerous mutations that need to be treated. I would now say, I'm not quite sure anymore.
That's right.
You know, I was one of the homozygous MTHFRs and my COMTs and my PEMT, which has to do with choline metabolism. And so my summary is I look for, I think choline is very important. I do look at, you know, these SNPs, but I don't put as much emphasis on it as I used to. I find it fascinating. It's potentially a very deep rabbit hole to bring somebody into. You know, they can go, oh, this is me. I could get this. I could get that. Could be my problem. And suddenly, you know, it's like, narcissism.
Oh.
You know, anyway, you know, it's like, let's pull back here and see the big picture. The reason we did this is just to sort of see if there's anything egregious. So, and also the APOE4, you know, 4-4, you say, well, that is associated with dementia and Alzheimer's. However, it is the best responder to a ketogenic diet, meaning
wow,
no carbs. And so, these are the things you put together, and the reason I even care to open up the genome thing is it's almost getting to be in common parlance. You know, it's like, oh, look at my genes. So you don't want them to go crazy, but you want to sort of mollify that whole little anxiety they might have. So we cover that.
I was giving a talk and somebody said to me, if I have a certain gene structure, can that be overcome? And I said to them, well, you know, genetics are not necessarily destiny. In order for a gene to be a problem, it has to manifest. And it isn't necessarily going to manifest. And if it's not manifesting, you don't necessarily have to do something about it.
Right. That's wise advice.
Even with the MTHFR, if somebody's perfectly healthy and they're homozygous for C677T, you know, and yet they're healthy and they're eating well and they have a good life and they're happy, why do you have to give them B12 or, you know, why do you have to give them methylfolate or, you know, you don't necessarily have to.
Right. Absolutely. So I find this very fascinating. It gets better as I go deeper. I want to go back on the MTHFR. Back when I had discovered it, it was basically through, I didn't have a large autistic practice, but I did find the highest correlation of MTHFR was with autism.
Yes.
And so it did make me say, you know, there is some relevance here. Let's go deeper with it. And that's what got me into that.
Yes.
Now I would say I wouldn't ignore it. I would also say, can we get said child on a ketogenic diet?
Yeah.
You know, is it possible to move in that direction for the whole GABA aspect?
Oh, yes.
In the microbiome change.
That's really hard, though, with kids in the spectrum. What I see with kids in the spectrum when the parents bring them in, the kids are so particular about what, you know, and if they haven't been raised eating a basically whole foods diet, they've been raised in sort of a conventional American sort of diet. They've got the things that they like and the parents just get them fed. It can be really hard to have them, those kids, change their diets.
Yeah, no, I agree. There's a documentary, I think a couple of years ago, called the Magic, I think it's called The Magic Pill. And it puts people attempting a ketogenic diet in a number of different, you know, the elderly, somebody about arthritis, and somebody, I don't know if it's post heart disease, diabetes, but they also focused on an autistic child.
Yes.
And it brought that family how it got to be outrageously difficult, and then there was a snapping point in which they just provided no alternatives, and you wouldn't believe the behavioral change. And, you know, this little girl happened to be, you know, was those little goldfish, you know.
The little crackers.
Yeah.
Sure.
Right, little crackers. That was her go-to food before. She had, you know, crap for her diet. And now, finally, first removing, and enduring. It was just incredible that they would, enduring it, you know, they went as far as making bone broth, and everything was, a ketogenic diet with veggies. And now the child won't go back to anything else. This is what she'll take. So there was such a behavioral change in this child, strictly about dietary change, that you had to ask. It's an N of one, of course. I don't think there's ever going to be an N of 40 for a study, for a lot of reasons. But there'll be a lot of N of one. There'll be another N of one. But
right.
That point of, and this is hard for a physician, for anybody to sort of say, this is the right direction to go. I'm not saying it's going to be easy for your first step. It might be progressively more difficult, and then it's going to be starting to get easier to the point that you're going to forget that you ever had a difficult time. But to say that the transition, now we're just talking metabolically, your body's having to do some work here, and we're going to help you out with it. Maybe that's where the supplements come in and various other ways, but eventually, you know, you're going to have your own pair of skates going out in the pond by yourself and knowing how to skate and not have to worry about it, meaning that that's life is going to work out that way and you're not going to feel restricted.
Right.
But initially, you're going to go, what, no cookies? Can I have Diet Coke versus Coke? So these conversations of, well, that's marginally better. And if you want to say yes part-time, say, but that's going to be taken out too. We're going to get to real food. Remember how your grandparents ate?
They
didn't ask this question.
Yeah.
Right. And say, if your grandmother was in the room, what do you think she'd say?
Oh, I don't want to go there.
Well, you lived on a farm.
Then, huh?
I did live on a farm, yeah. But my grandmother, well, never mind. She my grandmother taught my mother how to cook, and that is that you basically cook things until they are completely and ultimately dead and will never come back to life.
Those poor women, I think they were angry. They were not happy people, and they didn't like pleasure was not something that came to them easily.
Yeah.
So where you're very much about the pleasure of cooking and eating good food, and like you and your sister did a 180 on that.
Yeah, big thanks to Wally. I think my dad was the
because he liked to eat good food.
Well, he's Italian, you know. He's like, you know, Italian. Yeah. He had a little more pizzazz, a little more life to him.
Yeah, Ron is like one of those classic, you know, earlier in the century when Italians migrated to Connecticut and started farms and stuff. He comes from that stock. His mother does not.
No.
Yeah, mother was a League of Nations. So
yes.
All right. So Carl, we've got 2 minutes left. Please, if you could give us one more piece of amazing advice, and then we'll wrap up and tell people to get a hold of you, and then talk about the fact that we're coming to North Carolina in a month. So
you are. Wow.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yep.
Well, that would be neat. I would say then the one thing, the most exciting part that I find in it, and I'll be releasing an interview for our podcast of a psychiatrist from Harvard, is taking keto to psychiatry. And so it's treating bipolar, schizophrenia, obsessive compulsive disorders. That's difficult. Can you imagine?
We talk
about autism, and you know, there's another show. It's like, it's exciting, and yet it's pretty dangerous. You know, because they send the patients go home, and now you're saying they're going to eat differently. You know how hard it was for them to stay on their medication? And so now we're talking about diet therapy. Anyways, it's obviously working out successfully for many. And it's dramatic. And I would say it's an extension of what we talked about, the GABA, and it goes well beyond that.
Yes. Well, and that's what you've heard of the GAPS diet, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and so that's the idea that you know the GAPS diet starts out when you start on the GAPS diet, you're basically eating bone broth and maybe some meat, and that's it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's how they start, and that's how they induct you into the GAPS. And the GAPS diet is basically a healthy, low carb. I don't know if it's actually ketogenic, but it may be. But it's just a low carb diet, and they start you basically keto carnivore.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? And when you track that back to a lot of, you know, a lot of roads lead to the same destiny. So to say.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, but
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, good. Well, it's good to talk to you guys both.
You too.
Right. So we will talk more down the road. Please tell me when you get to North Carolina.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Well,
so if you want to reach Carl, if you want to learn more about Carl, Carl's website is ketonaturopath.com. That's K-E-T-O. naturopath.com, and you can read his whole story, and that has information about how to get a hold of him. Did you want to tell us any other ways to get hold of you, or is that good?
I think that's fine. We have a Facebook group where people have to answer questions to get in, saying they're just interested in keto, and those are pretty much the two. We're working on a larger program from my experience of working with people to kind of really help people for the period of 4 months to make a transition for serious issues. Okay.
Well, it's been fantastic to talk to you again. Very inspiring, and your enthusiasm is infectious. And just what you have done, what you have shown and what you've demonstrated, you're doing very, very important work. And thank you for doing it. And I'm really pleased and proud to have you on and, you know, support these ideas. So thank you again.
Yes, it's exciting both ways.
Yeah.
We did it before.
Right.
Well, thank you, guys.
All right. You take care, Carl, and hopefully we'll see you next month. All right.
You bet.
So. All right, take care. So that was Carl Goldkamp. He's a naturopathic physician, and I worked with him in Mystic for a while, and then, you know, we went our separate ways. He had a practice in Lyme, and now he's ultimately found his way to Bern, North Carolina. So that was a really interesting, another interesting and informative talk about ketogenic diets. So you have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the call-in talk show about health and natural medicine. I'm Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician with my co-host Ron Meniza. You can also email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also leave questions or comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at Fran Storch, ND. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores.